It literally is AMPD after dark now.
Yeah.
Welcome to NPD Soundbites from ANPD, the Association for Nursing Professional Development.
This is the NPD Forecast. Your hosts, Jen Bodine and Jillian Russell, are nursing professional development specialists with years of dynamic NPD experience. Jen and Jill round out ANPD's nursing professional development practice team and are your personal environmental scanning forecasters. This podcast series features topics that are relevant to the forecasting of future trends for NPD practice and discusses implications that you can apply to your daily practice. Welcome, everyone, to the NPD Forecast. I'm Jillian Russell.
And I'm Jen Bodine. Joining us today, we have a panel of experts outside of the NPD specialty and healthcare industry. This idea came to light through our journey into the design thinking framework, and anybody who has been listening to anything Jillian and I have produced over the last 6 to 8 months know that we are crushing pretty hard on design thinking right now. So I think typically when we have an issue in nursing professional development, we tend to look for solutions from subject matter experts inside of our own industry. But according to research, looking outside of your field can often produce more successful outcomes. Finding people who work in different industries, but that share deep similarities, can be very powerful. Today, we've brought together marketing experts, a theater guru, a public affairs officer, and a naval aviator to give us tips on how to provide innovative solutions within the nursing professional development specialty. And Jillian, I don't know, but that sounds to me like a five people walked into a bar joke.
Yes, Jen, looking to industries that share some of the basic tenets can lead to profound innovation that you would not necessarily find sticking to your own industry. With that, let's jump in with our first guest. Captain Thomas Jethro Bodine has been a naval aviator for 23 years. Throughout his service, Captain Bodine has been able to ensure the physical and psychological safety of his sailors in high-stress, no-fail environments during his assignments as an instructor at Top Gun. As a commanding officer of VFA 22, his current position as a deputy air wing commander for carrier Air Wing 7, where he immediately supervises 9 squadrons and over 2,100 people. He has a bachelor's in electrical engineering from Ole Miss, a Master of Art in National Security and Strategic Studies from the Naval War College. So I have to ask, how do you prefer I address you? Captain Bodine, Jethro?
Jethro or Thomas or Tommy or hey you, whatever gets my attention.
That's a lot of options.
I think just keep it informal, I think is the big thing.
Okay, perfect. So Thomas, Jethro. Jethro, okay, we can do that. That's your call sign. Healthcare has often looked to aviation for its culture of safety. Given the current pandemic and the restrictions associated with COVID to keep Navy units operational, what are some practices that naval aviation uses to provide for the individual sailor's health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I just want to say thank you for having me on board. I think it's an honor to be a part of this esteemed group here. So thank you very much. Yes, COVID, as everybody knows, has been a challenge for every industry, to include the military. Just recently, the Navy has updated safety standards and the way we go about mental and physical health for our sailors. And the new program that the Navy came up with is known as the Command Resiliency Team. And a portion of that Command Resiliency Team, or CRT, is this Human Factors Council. And the Human Factors Council specifically is made up of both direct supervisors and indirect supervisors, middle management. And then you have some auxiliary folks to include chaplains and doctors. And then you also have peers, and what they do is they get together and basically talk about every individual within the unit at a specific level. Now, the intent for this is basically early identification for at-risk individuals in an attempt to head off adverse effects, allowing things to snowball, if you will, from small issues into large issues. And that's why it's important to get that diverse group of people, not only their supervisor, but their peers, and then people like Chaplain Corps and the Medical Corps to come in and talk to those individuals.
Again, when we start thinking about these factors, it's important to note that there's no exact formula for determining an at-risk individual. The big thing is that you need to get all the people in the room who have an impact on this individual's life so that you can develop a big picture of that person so that you can implement the appropriate controls. Some of those big picture factors may include some physiological, psychological, social, and/or professional. Includes things like medical conditions and qualifications, emotional stressors, interpersonal relationships, some financial challenges even, and then performance trends, the training that person's received, and their motivational factors. Now, for the actual meeting itself, once you get all your peers and leaders into the room and you start going through the list of your staff members, you're going to want to be cognizant that we make sure that we don't turn this into an airing of the grievances or a general rumor mill. And to that point, there is a point where you start bringing up issues, but an in-depth discussion of sensitive personal or professional matters is not required. It's just simply identifying those so that you can put the big picture together. And then it is important that when everybody leaves the room, so this meeting's over with, that everybody continues to ensure the privacy and confidentiality of information discussed at that meeting.
Thank you. So Tommy, I would like to just have full disclosure here, is my husband. We're practicing a little nepotism this evening, and I highly recommend it for everybody who decides they want to start looking outside their industry. Start with your family, start with your friends, and then go out from there. So I really see this aligning with things like our nurse residency programs and our preceptor programs, because I feel like in the time of COVID, when everybody's high stress, these are probably two of the more stressful situations, because you have nurses who are just coming out of school and probably aren't getting the type of orientation they would in non-COVID times. And then preceptors who are trying to take care of highly critical patients while training new grad nurses. So I see value in this type of program where the preceptor, the manager, the NPD practitioner, and peer group might sit around and have a conversation with about how the new grad nurse is doing, what might be going on at home that's affecting them, how they're being affected by learning during times of COVID, and just having a very frank and transparent conversation. And Jillian, as you know, in the last couple trend lines, we've actually focused on mental health a lot, because we're getting a lot of clinician burnout. And if we don't look to support our clinicians with programs like this, then we risk mental health issues or a high turnover rate. What do you think? Do you think that translates over to our type of programming? Do you see that aligning with things that we do within the hospital setting?
Absolutely. I think you hit it right on the nail right on the head there. Because what this, it's a holistic look at the individual, right? And so you said it exactly right. So is it psychological? Is it emotional? Is it interpersonal relationships, finances, performance trends, training, motivational factors? And so you get a group of people in the room that can speak to those things for each individual. And it's important that you go through each individual so that you can identify, hey, somebody maybe just got married, and during COVID, that can be a big stressor, or even leading up into it. So how is that affecting their performance within the unit? Do we need to give them a little more time off? Do we need to put them in less stressful situations, or do we need to help them out by adding more support structures around them while they're at work? And then, of course, you can dissect that into all the areas I've already talked about. But that is, generally speaking, the role of this Human Factors Council.
Thank you very much. So next, our next guest is Jimmy Russell. He's the Senior Public Affairs Officer at NASA's Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio, where he manages communications for a wide range of spaceflight and aeronautic projects. He's also the center's chief speechwriter and serves on NASA's crisis response team. Jimmy has a bachelor's degree in journalism and strategic media from Middle Tennessee State University and corporate communications graduate certificate from Cornell University. He's worked in public affairs and public relations for nearly 12 years, prior to which he served 6 years in the United States Navy as an aviation warfare systems operator. And most importantly, he is Jillian Russell's husband. My question for you is, or let me make a statement first. One of our major roles as MPD practitioners is that as a change agent. And with that comes our responsibility to bring messaging to staff to help them to embrace this change. Unfortunately, in the world of NPD, we often are aware of this change last minute. So it makes it really difficult for us to come up with that messaging that are going to help our end users accept this change. So public affairs officers have specific expertise in creating this type of messaging. So Jimmy, given your expertise in public relations and strategic communications, how do you plan for and go about crafting a message for a desired outcome?
Yeah, that's a problem no matter what, right? Whether it's last minute, whether you have 2 weeks to write something. I think as content creators, we have this, I don't know the best word for it, but there's this need to constantly talk, right? So you want to tell a full story. You want to include all the facts, all the people, all the things. And that necessarily doesn't create the best outcome for the audience, right? And it doesn't get to your desired outcome. So we have this thing, it's really based in reputation management and change management and even crisis management a little bit. It's called the value equation. And I can't for the life of me remember where I heard this. So don't cite me on this because I'll probably totally screw it up, right? But it basically, it looks at and it asks four simple questions before you start working on any content. And those questions are, what are the results or outcome do we want? What behaviors do we want to change? What awareness problems do we have? And what are the best channels and means of getting this message across? And I think if you step back, even if you have an hour to turn something around and you initially ask yourself that question, and if you can answer all four of those questions, you're going to create a product that's going to deliver the message and get to those desired outcomes. Really what it gets down to is, you have to know your audience, right? You have to meet your audience where they're at. And that's really driven by demographics. So I don't know, like in a hospital setting, how much demographical information that you all have, right? Whether that's, you know, the age of the people on various units, the education level, things like that. But you really need to get down into it and try to, and really try to dig through it to figure that out. Because when you look at, I'm going to be a little bit ageist here, but when it's old versus young and things like that, attention spans are different. The way they consume media is different. The platforms that they're on are different, things like that. So you really need to be able to meet your audience where they're at. And we can get into it later of different writing styles and things like that, that we use in public affairs to really hammer those messages home. But I think it really comes down to that value equation and answering those four questions before you even start writing and knowing who you're writing to, answering those questions and executing from there.
I really like that, Jimmy, because part of our leadership role is, or part of, I think, being a good leader is getting to know the people around you. And that includes that demographic information, but that's also part of being a good educator, is really understanding your learner and their preferences and their styles. So I'm glad that crosses over multiple industries. And I think that Tommy has a question for you.
Jimmy, yeah, I was just wondering, for the non-initiated, can you expound upon what you mean by meet the audience where they're at?
The demographic information drives that content, right? So you have to be able to, one, know your people, know their backgrounds, know the education levels or the comprehension levels that they have, right? So we run into this a lot at NASA, where I work with a bunch of master degree and PhD level engineers, but we write to a general public audience. Unfortunately, the general public comprehension level in the United States is about an eighth grade reading level. So you have to be able to take that content and really break it down from somebody who has a PhD in aerospace engineering and talk about how a combustion engine works for an aircraft, right? So that's the one thing, is being able to break down to a comprehension level of your audience. Secondly, and especially in today's world, it's meeting them where they're at online. So you know, you look at an older audience, they're probably going to be more apt to want to read something printed. So if that's a newsletter or something like that, that's printed on a weekly or monthly basis, they're going to be more apt to read something in email and be able to digest more content, more factual, more background information, where somebody who's a millennial or a Gen Z, they're going to want something quick and easy. So I want to be able to look at it on my phone, and I need you to tell me what it is and why it's important to me in the first, call it 50 to 100 words. So that's kind of meeting them where they're at, right? So it's what the content is and how you're writing to it, and then also how you're delivering it to your audiences. And I think one of the things that's a little difficult to do because it takes extra time is when you have an important message, you have to be able to write and deliver it via multiple channels. So I know that in this unit, we have a bunch of older nurses and they like to read things in a newsletter. So I'm going to write a long form 250 word thing. And I'm smiling a little bit here because I've seen some of these 250 plus word things. Or, you know, is it something that we can send out in a tweet or an Instagram or something like that that's quick and easily digestible for that millennial audience? So
awesome.
So, Jimmy, I think we're literally speaking the same language because I had one of my talking points that I wanted to hit home. I literally underlined meet nurses where they are. And so I think, you know, even across industries, audience is important wherever you are. And we were thinking, you know, from the marketing angle of, are they gathering in a break room? Then put your message in the break room. Do you know they're frequently checking your company or your facility intranet for information? Well, make sure you're posting something there. I hadn't even thought of the newsletter. I'm sure there are newsletters, whether they're e-newsletter or print newsletter. Another really great example of where you can get your message out in front of your nurses. And then, you know, you've talked about, you kind of hit the nail on the head with the tech tools. I know that Aaron was going to talk about tech tools a little bit later and how NPD practitioners can leverage that in their communications.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's almost embarrassingly so, but in a previous job, we looked at like how much information could we get across on the signs that you hang up above urinals or on the back of stall doors, right? Because people spend 30 seconds to a minute there. So how much can we get somebody to digest while they're there in the restroom, right? So it's literally meeting them where they're at in the simplest and most explicit terms sometimes. So.
Okay, Jimmy, so I've got to ask. I hate potty grams. And here's why. Because they're no longer effective. Everyone's bringing their phone in there. For 30 seconds, I go pee. I'm going to look on my phone, check my email, check my social media, send a text to my sister, and take a selfie. So I don't think anybody's looking at these anymore. Are you noticing, like, have we stopped at that point?
Like, yeah, this was probably, so this is when I worked in professional sports. So that was, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. So yeah, it's definitely everything that we should be doing is on the phone. Every possible thing should be mobile friendly. And I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit later with tech tools, right? But tech friendly, mobile friendly, and it better be short, concise, and to the point. Because nobody has time to sit there and read 250 plus words anymore. So
I want to shift a little bit to Andy. And she actually asked Jimmy a question a moment ago. So Andy Leslie is the marketing director for the Association for Nursing Professional Development. With 10 plus years of experience in association marketing, Andy is responsible for driving results and achieving ANPD's strategic goals in membership, continuing professional development, event attendance, products and services, social media, advertising, and brand awareness. She is passionate about delivering unique and meaningful communications for professional associations that resonate with members and other target audiences. Andy holds a Bachelor of Arts in Public Relations and Advertising from Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, and is a certified nonprofit professional. I also want to take this moment to introduce her colleague, Erin Espy. She is a marketing senior coordinator for ANPD. She manages and creates content for ANPD's social media channels, including membership, annual convention, and product marketing campaigns. Erin has worked in marketing and communications for association and nonprofit organizations for nearly 10 years and is passionate about finding creative and innovative ways to share their missions and impact. Erin holds a Bachelor of Arts in Interdisciplinary Studies, focusing on mass communication and social justice from the University of Missouri. So, Jen and I have had the pleasure of working with both of you, Erin and Andy. And as you know, NPD practitioners frequently have to market their educational activities. This can often be in the form of an email or, like we just had mentioned, a sign posted in a bathroom stall. And marketing, a sole purpose can be to come up with creative strategies for attracting consumers to a particular brand. And in this case, it's the NPD brand. So Andy, I'd like to start with you. What would you say are the most important considerations to market yourself or your department?
Sure. Thanks, Julian. So a lot of what Jimmy said, I think is definitely important. Understanding your audience and what they care about, what's in it for them, will be really critical to getting your message across. So instead of, well, the details of your program are important, the when, the where, the what's going to happen, but why should they take time out of their busy day to attend this program or engage in this training? And getting to that, what's in it for me? Why should I care? Taking it one step further than not the feature, but the actual benefit can really go a long way. Jimmy also hit on this idea that hitting a message one time isn't going to help. We always try to build in multiple touch points in multiple channels or formats, because it usually takes about at least three times of communicating your message before it starts to sink in, before someone starts to pay attention, and before they take action. And it doesn't always have to be three emails. We, you know, marketing best practice is a multi-channel integrated approach. And what we mean by multi-channel is, again, getting back to that idea of meet them where they are, have a print piece, put a flyer in their mailbox, put a graphic image on your intranet, send them a dedicated email, tap them on the shoulder, give them a phone call, ask them to attend. Those are different ways that you can communicate the same message and get those nurses thinking about what they're missing out on and how it can benefit their career or their care of patients. You know, the other thing I think always gets lost is demonstrating value. And I think a really important part of demonstrating that value is setting some goals up front, so that when you are going through that planning process, you're making sure you collect the appropriate data or information. Jimmy hit on it. Data is so critical to understanding your audience, but setting those data points in your planning process so that you can go back and measure the ROI. And ROI doesn't have to necessarily be a financial benefit. It could be a non-financial benefit. It could be an intangible benefit. It could be something like a shift in culture or building trust or increasing job satisfaction or comfort with their job role. It could be retention. It could be, do you want to be known as a great place to work? There are other ROIs that you can get. And if you set those goals up front, you can measure against them. And then the most important part, I think, is sing your praises. We are all really bad about talking about ourselves and what we're good at and what we've achieved. And whether your supervisor asks for it or not, or even if you ask them and they say no, get that dashboard in front of them. Get those ROI data points in front of them and say, look what I achieved. Look at all the different things that I did. Look, both the quantity of work that you're doing as well as the quality of work. And you can do that through setting those measurable goals and demonstrating your value.
I have a quick question for you there, Andy. Speaking to an audience internalized, so really your own workforce and marketing to your own workforce, I was just talking with a colleague of mine and we were lamenting a bit about the ability to motivate people, especially during COVID times. And so I was wondering, what are you seeing with regards to intrinsic motivation versus showing people incentivizing people, you know, leadership for leadership's sake versus, hey, if you do X, then you will get Y kind of thing, instead of being purely transactional in that way.
Sure. Trying to communicate and be successful and motivate in a pandemic, I mean, there's no playbook for that. Fortunately, unfortunately, I'm not sure. I think we're all kind of figuring it out as we go. You know, we're coming up on that 1 year anniversary of the pandemic, you know, and the joke going around social media is we're about to celebrate the 2 weeks that we were going to be away from our jobs. And it's crazy to think that we've been doing this for a year. But what I'm seeing is, again, it goes back to this idea of empathy. We also have to do our jobs. We can't necessarily give you the time off. You can't walk away. We all want that. We all need it. You know, we all understand this idea of mental health. But if we can show that we understand, and it's not just you, it's me, we're all feeling it, I think that goes a long way. So this idea of empathy and being heard. I think we're, again, so bad at saying, we hear you. We're making these changes because we heard you. We're putting this training in place because we heard you. We're putting together this program. We're launching this new well-being for nurses program because we understand where you are, what you're going through, and we want to give you the tools, you know, to go through it. And that's really, I think, the key is you know, the empathy and the understanding and being heard, listening.
So there is the direct tie to the design thinking framework, the empathy step. And, you know, as we've heard from both Tommy, Jimmy, and now Andy, I don't know, Jen, but I'm hearing so many correlations to the steps in the educational design process and our needs assessment process and the design thinking framework. I mean, how many aha moments and alignments can you have at one time?
Well, Jillian, and I think that just goes to prove how much our industries, even though they seem so vastly different, how much just kind of, like you said, those tenets align with each other, our core values and what we look out for. So I would agree with you. So Andy, what I really like about your message is that one and done is not the way to go. You need to hit at multiple points. And I think that's something we fail to do as NPD practitioners. We think we do this one mode of communication and then it's it and we move on. And whether that's because we're busy or we just don't know other ways to do it, we are definitely, I think, failing our learners when we don't provide those multiple platforms for communication. So thank you so much.
All right. So Erin, I'd like to ask you, what innovative technology would you recommend that we as NPD practitioners could use to market either ourselves or our activities in our practice settings?
Yeah, so I do this every day. Andy and I do this every day. And I wanted to take this time to really share the three tools that I use every day that help me work smarter, not harder, on a low to non-existent budget to achieve all of this awesome marketing and communication that we're talking about here. So my first number one tool is Canva. And I think especially as we're talking about one and done doesn't work, creating the same message for multiple mediums, Canva is a godsend for that. Canva is a free tool. There's also a paid version that's only about $12 a month. And you can create graphics and videos and animated GIFs and posters and flyers and postcards. All of these sizes are built in. So you don't have to wonder, oh, what's the appropriate size for a Facebook post? It's just in there already. And all of these beautiful templates are in there for you already. You can set your branding colors so that when I need to make a quick graphic to promote an event, it takes me very little time because all of those tools are in there for me. So I really suggest Canva for that. My second one is Biteable, which is a video service. It's not free, but it's only about $250 a year for a license. And, you know, whether or not potty papers work, I don't know. Put up a potty paper in the bathroom using Canva. But if Jen's going to be sitting there scrolling on her phone, let's also hit her with a video in her Facebook feed. And so Biteable makes these really beautiful, fun, flashy, catchy videos very, very easily. It doesn't take a whole video team, a whole production staff to produce like a really eye-catching video that's going to get your message across. And then the last one, Andy was talking about how we need to prove how valuable our time and efforts into all of these campaigns are. We need to show that this Facebook campaign, you know, brought 15 people into this training, which resulted in them knowing this particular skill. We need to be able to prove why that Facebook campaign brought all those people in. So you need to get all of those metrics. And Facebook and Twitter and all of your social platforms, they have all those metrics available, but it's going to take a lot of time to really dig through and figure out what are the right metrics to be sharing. How do those metrics compare to where I should be? And so we use Sprout Social a lot, which is a tool that you can actually use to schedule all of these posts. You can use it as kind of a listening service, so you can see what other accounts similar to yours are talking about. But what we really love it for is for all of the stats. So you can see how many engagements were on a post, meaning how many people clicked on it or liked it or shared it, how many impressions there were. So how many people just saw it in their feed. And I think it also does a really good job of explaining what all of those numbers mean, so that when you go and you show them to your C-suite executives, you can be really educated about what they mean and where your work is fitting into the greater scheme of things. So Canva, Biteable, and Sprout Social are my three must-haves on a very small budget.
Erin, I want to say, because I worry about when we talk about our seasoned nurses and what they're comfortable with as using technology, I'm afraid I am actually becoming a little seasoned, i.e. just a little salt and pepper, no cayenne yet. But I did have to ask Erin to show me how to use Instagram the other day, because I had no idea. So I think we're all teachable for this, to meet people where they're at. You may have to come, and I had to swallow a little bit of pride, and God bless her. She totally sent me a video, a step-by-step on how to do it, but look for your resources out there. Like, I think our seasoned nurses really lend that experience to our more novice nurses, but then our novice nurses bring something to the table. I will also say that there are some nurses who are way more seasoned than me that can run circles around me in the technology. So do not have any misconceptions about age having anything to do with your comfort with technology. And I love it because Andy just said, hey, get out there and ask a kid or a neighbor to help you. Go outside your network. That's what we're talking about, right? Outside your industry and outside your network. So I think it pays off in the end to really just put yourself out there and learn these new things and find ways, different, new, innovative ways to engage our learners. So thank you so much, Erin. That was awesome. So I intentionally saved this last person for last, because my husband says, I think life is a musical. Now, mind you, I also sound like a cat who is getting neutered when I sing, but I absolutely love the theater and can appreciate that suspension of disbelief that it gives us in our day to day. And I just love how it's able to take me out of my own world, especially in this COVID environment where you're just looking for something else than your current reality. It is my pleasure to introduce Jamie Yanishevsky, and she's a transplant from Nashville, Tennessee to beautiful Northern Michigan. She's the mother of two young firecrackers, Molly and Maxon. Jamie has a bachelor's in communications from East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma, and has been involved in theater in one way or another since elementary school, including starting a small community theater in Mount Juliet, Tennessee, as president of the board for Street Theater Company, a professional theater in Nashville, Tennessee, and 7 years as the sales and marketing director for a musical theater production company based out of Nashville. With all the challenges of the last year, one silver lining of COVID is that she is now on her heart's path to becoming a Montessori trained guide. This summer, she will be leading 2-week-long theater camp at her children's school and hopes to develop a theater program for children in Northern Michigan. So I love all of that about you, Jamie. So I am involved in simulation, or I was heavily involved when I was actually practicing in the hospital. And one of the things that I found was most difficult when we brought healthcare professionals in to run their simulation is they had a very difficult time getting into the scenario and removing themselves from the present time. And that really, really affected their skill set. So theater seems to be all about removing people from their current reality into an alternate reality filled with endless possibilities, which is what we need to do when we're running a simulation. Mm-hmm. MPD practitioners can strive, but we fail to set up realistic scenarios through simulations where our learners are fully able to immerse themselves in the experience. So there's a couple questions I do want to ask you. The first one is, what are the best practices that you can share as it relates to setting the scene for a given scenario? And the second one is, we often use clinical simulations where we use standardized patients. So can you speak to why actors are ideal for this role?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me on. I'm really honored. And I spent many years working at Vanderbilt with nurses and developed this very deep appreciation and respect for the medical community during that time. And especially during a pandemic, I just want to really say thank you to all of our healthcare workers and, you know, first responders for everything that you have done in the last year. Okay, so I think many folks may not understand how important this aspect is to training. It gives, you know, doctors and nurses a real chance to experience a scenario, to assess and diagnose and investigate in a very real, filling way without the real life consequences of getting it wrong, right? Or missing something. And training is so much better when they feel like they're in the real situation, speaking to what you just asked me. I believe personally that professional actors are best for this. You know, it's worth paying them. And one reason is because they're very serious about their craft. They take this very seriously. And in most cases, they take the participation in this kind of training incredibly seriously as well. Like they understand, like I'm impacting how this medical professional might in the future, you know, diagnose or investigate, or how they might have empathy or lack empathy in some way, you know, bedside manner. So some of the best practices in theater, one would be setting the scene, like you mentioned. Set is an integral part of as we welcome our audiences into the theater. That's the first thing they see, right? They hear the background music, but they also, they see this set, whether it's minimal or whether it's very ornate and intricate. And so how we set a hospital or a patient room, what are their props and their tools that are sitting there that are real to life? What are the costumes? Are they in their lab coat? And do they have their stethoscope around their neck? And, you know, all of those types of things. The character research, you know, understanding what they need to bring to these simulations. And they're very serious about doing that prior to coming, especially when they have an idea of, you know, maybe what virus or what illness they have thrust upon them. Then developing their motivation. I know people make a big joke about, I need to find my motivation, but you know, why am I here? What am I feeling? Why am I seeing a doctor? Why am I seeing a nurse? Am I scared? Do I know anything? You know, like, have I taken to the internet to get all of my information? So do I come scared about something much worse? The next thing would be notes and feedback or critique. This type of a situation or simulation makes us better, you know, that it gives us a chance to say, what did I miss? What did I get wrong? Did I have empathy for my patient? Did I ask the right questions? Did I diagnose this situation correctly? And most importantly, rehearsal. We would never perform a show for you without having intense rehearsal, right? And we would never come before you without being the best that we can be at our absolute peak for you on opening night through the entire run of the show. So if we don't practice, then we're not our best. So that's what I would say to answer your questions. I hope I answered them all.
No, you did. But would you say that people who gravitate towards theater actors have a certain are a little more empathic than maybe your standard person, because you really do have to be able to assume the role of somebody and understand that. And I ask that because I have a girlfriend in California who runs simulations. And when she uses standardized patients, she says it's so impactful to the learners afterwards during the debriefing, which is the most important part of a simulation. When that standardized patient is able to sit there and maintain that persona and say, you made me feel like this when you said this, rather than having me, layman Jen, pretending to be a patient, when you get these people who, I would you say, are just more naturally empathetic to kind of be able to convey that. A good actor, I feel, just has that passion and that thing, and they're able to take that learner and really make them think, they know this is an actor, but they're essentially saying, holy crap, like I seriously upset this person when I said this way.
Yes, I absolutely think that a professional actor is the best way to go. They are empathetic and they can, they're outside of themselves because this wasn't a real scenario for them. So they don't have the real world implications that someone else might have. Like they really feel it, I think, and they know how to feel it and get in touch with that and respond in the notes section. Like we talked, they know better how to give a response as to how that person performed.
Thank you. I think it's so amazing that we are able to take something from the arts, and I guess healthcare is kind of its own art form as well, but to take something from the arts and be able to translate it to how we can better our practice.
Jamie, I'd like to ask you a question. In the arts, I think y'all are very good, especially in the theater, at eliciting emotional response. So I kind of want to take your comments and move it from the simulator out into the real world. And now I'm wondering if you can tell us something significant you find that we can borrow from the arts, that when we are recognizing people for their hard work that they're doing on the unit day in and day out, if there's some piece, some little trick or some factor you find to be the most significant part of delivering that emotional response so that people do indeed feel like they are thanked and appreciated and are continue to be motivated to continue to work.
So if I'm playing a role on stage, I'm not pretending that I am in this role, that it's me, Jamie, in this role. I am whomever I'm playing. And that's how I'm able to elicit a response, an emotional response in my audience, is because they believe it right along with me. And while they're peeking in on what's happening to me, that all fades away when I'm up on stage and I'm in the moment and in the situation. I hope that answered your question.
You're speaking to being genuine and people can feel
being
that.
Incredibly genuine, and people know the difference. And so the over people are directed to be extremely dramatic. And I think we would go to the point of saying campy or cheesy, and people can sense the difference in a very real way. And that impacts their overall experience as they walk out the door. So if you have not deeply moved them because you are genuine to your core, then nothing else matters. Honestly, they've wasted their money.
That's a great philosophy to have, I think, both as an actor, but also as a human being. So that's great.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I had a real quick question for Jethro, because Jamie mentioned debrief. And, you know, in my short flight career, pre-flight debrief always seemed to be kind of just a foregone conclusion. You're going through the motions there, trying to get to the point of the mission. But it always seemed like post-flight debrief was the more valuable of the two, to be able to look through what happened, what went wrong, what went great, what can we improve on for next. And I think in our world, you know, lessons learned are very important. So I'm wondering how, you know, you would apply a lessons learned or a post debrief to, you know, what the nurses do in this world.
Yeah. So I've talked to Jen about this. I think it's a great question. In the Navy, we have a process known as the PBED process, right? Navy has a bunch of acronyms, PBED, planning, briefing, execution, debriefing, right? And just as you said, the real learning happens at the beginning, at the end, right? So if I'm new to a skill set and I'm doing the planning for the flight, then that's where I'm going to learn a lot about it. Then I'm going to go brief it. And really, that's just a regurgitation of the information I know. And if I don't know it, then I'm not going to say it, or I'm going to say it incorrectly, right? Then you go execute the flight, and that will run mostly based off of skill sets and knowledge, and the enemy has a boat in my business, right? But then the debrief, as you said, is absolutely the most critical aspect of it. And in our scenario, in my work at least, individuals who are learning a new skill set will spend hours planning a 1.5 hour flight. And then they will spend about an hour briefing that so that they can go do it. And then for a 1.5 hour flight, the debrief, if it went poorly, can last upwards of 6.5 hours. And so you're talking about for a 1 hour actual execution, you're talking about the learning process occurring probably three and a half hours that they did on the planning side, on the front side of that. And then about, on average, somewhere between an hour and then at the worst, 6 hours of debriefing to pull out all the learning points from that. I think that translates into the nursing world. It's not a one for one because, you can't just stop. You've got other patients, generally speaking. So you can't just stop, but there needs to be a time when you go, okay, this significant event occurred. We're going to set time away from it to go and talk about it. And I think one of the most important aspects is being brutally honest in an atmosphere where you can be brutally honest. In the Navy and naval aviation, it is expected that when I get into the debrief, I bring up first and foremost anything that I did wrong before I talk about anything that anybody else did wrong. And in fact, I take it as a point of pride that I say everything I did wrong first, because if somebody else then brings up something that I did wrong that I didn't call out, then that is a knock on my ability to honestly self-assess. And so I think that plays well into an organization and a profession, quite honestly, that deals with life and death. So you need to be able to pull a group of people aside. And again, secondhand knowledge, all from Jen, but you have an ER code that goes poorly, right? It goes poorly not because it was an unrecoverable situation that the patient was in, but the actions of the individuals weren't necessarily synced. Right? But this is where you take that group aside, right? And you go, hey, let's do an honest self-assessment on what did I do right? What did I do wrong? What did we as a team do right? And what did we as a team do wrong? Because to your point, and you brought it up there, Jamie, is if I perform the best ever, right? But in doing so, I make the rest of my team work horrible because I don't listen to them. I don't react to what they're doing. And the whole team's fails, then I've ultimately failed. Who cares how good I was if the mission never succeeded? So absolutely, you're 100% correct. And you run the risk of asking an aviator about naval aviation, so I can talk forever about that. So I'll stop here, but say you're absolutely right in that the debrief is the most important aspect. And I think we need to build time into our evolutions to actually honestly self-assess our activities.
Theater is the same. Like our debriefs or our notes that we do at the end of the night. I mean, it's not the same in terms of like life and death situations that you guys all have going on. But, like if we're going to deliver a performance that allows everyone to escape and allows them to get out of their heads and out of their lives, that rehearsal that we do, comes with an hour to 2 hours of notes at the end of the night, no matter how tired you are. It's, it's the same. So you come back the next day and you fixed what went wrong that night. And then you have new things to fix the next night.
Do you guys do stuff like that, Andy, in the marketing world after you've done programs and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We definitely do it after events and, what worked, what didn't work, what will we change in the future? But I think you've made a really great point about us debriefing, when we conclude a campaign. I think sometimes we're always evaluating as we go and shifting as we go, and looking at the data and the trends and the feedback right in front of us that maybe we don't always think of something as concluded, but now my wheels are turning. about how we could be debriefing more often. We're bad at that too. We're bad at talking about ourselves and we're bad at debriefing.
What do you think, Erin?
Yeah, I agree. Definitely for events, but events have a very clear end point and our campaigns don't always have that very clear end point, but that's something of our own creation. And we could definitely work more of that conclusive debriefing in, especially as Andy was talking earlier about getting stats and putting them in front of your leaders, but when? And so I think it's important to, when you're looking at the lifespan of your campaign, to work that in.
I do appreciate the debriefing because that is something that is so crucial to both simulations and running a debrief after we have an event such as a code, so a highly critical event, and being able to break down what everybody did right, but also people being able to reflect. And I would not say we would ever do that for 6.5 hours, but we definitely do try to make the time for it. And I want to put a plug in for an event we are going to have at convention this year, which is called SimWars, in which we are in, because NPD practitioners debrief all the time, whether it's in simulation, whether it's after an educational activity, after a code. So we are actually holding an event for our NPD practitioners to come forth and show their debriefing prowess. They're going to watch scenarios, recorded simulated scenarios, and then they are going to debrief the team lead based on learning outcomes and show their skill set at that. And it's just something that some people are really great at, some people need to work on, but there's definitely always room for improvement on that. So I definitely appreciate that you said the very first person who goes, you go and you say all of the things that you could have done better. And that, I think that also paves the way for other people to feel comfortable to be able to do that. That's part of being a leader, right?
I actually do. I think it's important. I'm obviously a big believer in the debrief, and not my words, but somebody told me once, and I find it very true with not only this group that we're talking with today, but my interactions with nurses and nurse professionals and nurse educators is that it's very true that high performing people seek feedback. And I think it is important for us to remember that, and that we want to surround ourselves with high performing people. We want to encourage that, and we owe it to them both as leaders and as individuals to provide them that critical feedback to allow them to get better at their job. So I wanted to add that into the debrief discussion. I did have a question for Erin though, and if I can change subjects about 90 degrees straight away, and I wanted to tap in to your social justice background. So I wanted to tap into your social justice background and mix that with your media background. And obviously that is a big deal these days, right? Social justice. And I'm just wondering your thoughts, being a marketing professional and dealing specifically with technology, which I think in a lot of ways can amplify poor behavior, let's just say, and how you see that we as individuals and leaders can better communicate without fostering or allowing maybe the negative effects of social justice or injustice really to occur on our watch?
Yeah, absolutely. It is an important question. And I'm so happy that it's so much a part of the conversation right now. But yes, as a marketer, you do have to tread lightly because there are so many more important things going on in the world than, you know, the tweets that I'm putting out or whatever we're doing. And so I think that the most important thing is to acknowledge that. And it's a lot of what we've been talking about, especially when we're talking about COVID and motivating people. It's about empathy and it's about listening and not just shouting into the void, but really making sure that our messages are well-timed, are sensitive, and not tone deaf. And I think if you have any questions about that, I mean, just as Jimmy was saying, in terms of that list of questions that he asks about whether or not the content is going to be valuable, stop and ask the question before you put out the message. is this appropriate? Is this going to fit into the conversation that's happening right now? Is this a distraction that nobody needs right now? Listening is as important in marketing and communications, I believe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tommy, Jimmy, Andy, Aaron, and Jamie for joining us. Listeners, we hope that you have gleaned some great takeaways from our guests and their rich expertise. If you are interested in learning more about leveraging ideas outside of your industry or thinking outside of the box, we encourage you to check out the following resources. First, we've mentioned design thinking. University of Pennsylvania's Design Thinking for Health course is available for free online. Don't forget, we have a previous podcast episode with Renee Davis on the topic of design thinking. And for resources outside of NPD, we encourage you to take a look at Inc.com and Fast Track. You can also find these resources listed on the podcast discussion forum available through ANPD's website. In fact, we encourage you to share what other industries you find relevant to NPD practice. Please post your thoughts, comments, questions on this episode's thread in the podcast discussion forum. You can access this through the Tools and Resources tab at www.anpd.org. Choose the podcast forum and you will see this episode's topic. Remember, you can listen to our podcast series by subscribing to the NPD Forecast on the ANPD website on the podcast page, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio. Please note that Captain Thomas Jethro Bodine's views are his alone and are not necessarily the views of the United States Navy. See you next month.
This NPD Forecast series analyzes information gathered through environmental scanning. Our goal at ANPD is to be your leading resource for NPD practice. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star rating on your preferred podcast platform, as well as a review. And if you feel so inclined, share with your friends and colleagues on social media. Be sure to tag ANPD when you do. Those ratings and reviews help us grow this platform and extend our reach. As NPD practitioners, we know our strength is in our sense of community. So the more you share the NPD Forecast, the more valuable this environmental scanning resource will be. We would love to hear from you and encourage you to post podcast topic recommendations in the podcast discussion forum available on our website.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit our website at anpd.org.